from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point.
Listen, yeah, people. Listen to me. Don't try to buy no home down in Washington, D.C., cause it's a bush boy town. Ooh, it's a bush boy town.
Hootie Ledbetter was born in 1888 in Louisiana, lived hard, did prison time, became known in prison as Leadbelly, and then known to the world for his incredible torrent of song. It flowed into folk, it flowed into rock. A huge new collection of Leadbelly song is out this week from the Smithsonian Folkways Collection. This hour on Point, the deep musical history and influence of Leadbelly. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know the Leadbelly story? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Jeff Place, archivist at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. He co-produced Leadbelly, the Smithsonian Folkways Collection, big box set, and big accompanying collection of photos and essays. It's really quite an incredible thing. Jeff Place, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Well, hello there, Tom.
Why this huge collection and why now, Jeff?
Well, you know, I've been in charge of the archives, the Folklife Archives at Smithsonian for about 30 years and worked on a lot, spent most all that time working on with the collections. But one of the main collections we have is the Leadbelly material. And, I decided really I needed to kind of download my brain at some point with all the stuff I've sort of accumulated over the years. So I did the same exercise with Bob Santelli on a Woody Guthrie project a couple years ago, which went over quite well. So we decided, well, man, why don't we try to do the same thing for Leadbelly? So there we were.
This is an absolutely huge collection. It's amazing how much is in here, the range of it. You describe Leadbelly, Hootie Ledbetter, as a songster, a kind of human jukebox. What do you mean by that, Jeff?
Well, the term that refers to, you know, it's even true nowadays if you're a musician and you really, you know, want to make a steady living, you know, playing your own originals most of the time doesn't work. Usually, you know, if you play like the hits, you know, at a tavern or you play something, that's where, you know, you make your money. So there was a tradition in the South of a lot of these African-American guitar players who looked and walked and talked like blues people, who actually played a whole repertoire of stuff because they play places and, you know, and the people on the streets wanted to hear something they knew already. So people like, you know, Hootie Ledbetter and I think Mississippi John Hurt and a whole lot of others would play, like, you know, show tunes, and they play jazz, and they play Woody. In the case of Leadbelly, he played cowboy songs, Hawaiian music, you know, you name it, in addition to blues.
Take us back to his beginnings, where he was born, how he came up, how he got on this tough path in the South that led him to many years in prison in Texas and Louisiana.
Well, his father was a sharecropper in northwest Louisiana, Wes Ledbetter. And, you know, the option really was growing up and working on the, you know, on the farm with dad and picking cotton, which I guess didn't really appeal to him. So when he was young, he got exposed to other things. And he actually first started playing a little button accordion at local dances. And then eventually when he got older, he discovered a street called Fannin Street in Shreveport, which is the nearest big town, which was the red light district where they had barrel house piano players and wild, crazy stuff going on. And that's where he really got exposed to a lot of music. And those places were kind of rough. If you hang around rough places where people are drinking and fighting, trouble can follow you.
He had convictions for murder, attempted murder, long stretches in prison. In 1917, he was still fairly young. He was in Dallas as a protege for Blind Lemon Jefferson, his lead boy, sort of guide, companion, protege on the streets of Dallas. Was he learning music from the famous Blind Lemon?
He learned music his whole life, everywhere he went. I bet if he, like, walked into a building and some music was playing somewhere, he would, like, remember it when he left. But Lemon Jefferson was arguably probably the biggest-selling blues artist, in the 1920s. I mean, his records on Paramount Records were, like, big sellers, you know. He made a lot of record companies go out looking for, you know, other people like Lemon Jefferson when he really caught on. And he was traveling with Lemon, so I'm sure he picked lots of music up from Lemon. But, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if Lemon picked up stuff from Leadbelly.
Blues, spirituals, reels, cowboy songs, folk ballads, prison hollers. They were all in Lead Belly's enormous repertoire. Is one of his most famous songs, Midnight Special, old American folk song, became a popular prison song about a midnight train whose lights, if they were to shine through the bars, the inmates thought the warden might set you free. Here's Lead Belly from a recording by Moses Ash.
When you get up in the morning, when that big bell rings, pull the marcher to the table, you meet the same old thing, not talking on the table, ain't nothing in my pan. Never said anything about it, having trouble with the man, let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven loving light on me. Let the ever go to
Midnight Special, Lead Belly there, a prison song that somehow in his hands, Jeff Place, sounds like a spiritual.
Well, he took a song that had been around before. There's even a cowboy recording of it earlier on. And if you listen to his guitar playing here, what he tried to do with his guitar, oftentimes his 12-string guitar, is simulate the sound of the pianos he heard at these bars down in Shreveport.
Yeah.
So that's the touch where Lead Belly comes in. It's that guitar playing. It gives it that energy. He was playing this song in prison where it had been recorded by other prisoners, but he put in the geographical references, the things where he was, that made it kind of his own.
More than once, literally sang his way out of prison. The governor of Texas used to come down and listen to him. He was at Sugar Land Prison. Lead Belly sang, "If I had you, governor, like you had me, I'd wake up tomorrow and set you free." And the Texas governor eventually did.
Yeah, that was the mythology that followed Lead Belly out of prison. And, both states of Texas and Louisiana claim it was really, he earned his good time credits and was time to go anyway. But it made it for a great story. It was more likely in the case of Neff, who was the first governor, who actually, as you said, did come to the prison and liked coming to listen to hear Lead Belly play. The second time, O.K. Allen, the governor of Louisiana, actually never ever met Lead Belly. He recorded the song for John Lomax on a disc, and Lomax apparently left a copy off at the governor's office for the governor to listen to, and no one knows if he ever listened to it or not.
How did the Lomax brothers, who came down and quote-unquote discovered Lead Belly, how did they know he was there?
Well, it was a father and son team, actually, John and Alan.
Yeah, of course.
John it was a folklorist, and he was, he'd been based out of Harvard, and he was encouraged. First thing he wrote was a cowboy songs collection, and he was trying to find all these old songs, and he somehow thought that maybe if he went to prisons and found prisoners who'd been incarcerated for many, many years, it hadn't been exposed to evil things like radio, and maybe their music hadn't changed, he could find some pristine older version of songs. So he came up with this idea of prisoners. So he and his son Alan traveled around all over the South and got permission of, for sort of skeptical prison wardens to, to come record people. And they recorded quite a lot for this amazing collection they amassed at the Library of Congress. But the real true find, Alan later found Muddy Waters down in Mississippi. But the other real thing, big find for John was Lead Belly, the time he encountered him in Angola.
Hit the jackpot there. Of course, Lead Belly himself ended up on the radio, and he would begin and end many of those radio shows with his most famous song, Irene. Goodnight, Irene.
Irene, good night. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I get you in my dream. Sometimes I live in the country.
Lead Belly's Irene. Jeff Place has that and much more in a huge new collection, Lead Belly, the Smithsonian Folkways Collection, enormous box set. Jeff, describe for us how he came from Angola prison in Louisiana and the South to New York. How was that transition made?
Well, he had the misfortune of coming out of Angola in 1934, the height of the Depression, which, you know, wasn't a great time to come out and get a job, especially as an ex-convict. He asked John Lomax for a job, and John Lomax hired him as a driver, which actually worked out really well for both of them because he traveled with Lomax to other prisons in a subsequent period of time. And he sort of would warm up the prisoners. He would start playing kind of his songs for the prisoners. And so the prisoners got an idea what Lomax was looking for. And at the same time, he was picking up songs himself from the prisoners that Lomax was recording. It was at a prison in Arkansas where he actually heard Rock Island Line, which had been a sort of a advertising jingle for a railroad company for the first time. And then basically John Lomax, the folklorist, brought up Leadbelly back up north to a lot of academic conferences and colleges to kind of show his new discovery, this guy who was, you know, this amazing collector of songs, and present him to, like, you know, people who really were interested in the folklore.
And suddenly America felt like it was tapping into its own history, its own folk roots here. Mythology is a word you use. There's a lot of mythology surrounding Leadbelly. The story of his prison release itself out of Texas, is it true, or is it part of the mythology that was almost deliberately built up around him that he sang his way out?
Well, you know, supposedly in real life, he got out because it was time for him to get out. And it made a good story, you know. And, you know, and what happened when he got to New York City, that story and a lot of other things, you know, got very sensationalized in the press. You know, the press would write, I don't think Lomax, you know, intended this was, you know, he had dressed them, you know, him in prison outfits. But a lot of folk, you know, folklorists would have folk festivals where they dress Appalachian people in bib overalls and granny dresses and things. But so Lomax, you know, I don't think he intended for get quite where it went. But the papers were talking about how, you know, a sweet singer of the swamplands here to do a few songs between homicides.
Really played up that kind of dangerous man angle. You can hear echoes of that many decades later in the hip-hop world these days. Jeff Place, please stand by in Washington with the Smithsonian Folkways Collection box set on Leadbelly. Listeners, you can join us. Do you know the Leadbelly story? Up out of prison, the toast of New York, endless collector of American song. What do you hear in Leadbelly's voice, Leadbelly's song? Today, we're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Here's from a 1948 WNYC recording, Leadbelly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
If I had you, Governor, left like you got me, I'd wake up in the morning, I would set you free. Where you going? I'm going back to Mary. Oh, Mary. Ooh. Oh, Black Betty, bam a lamb, looky on a Black Betty, bam a lamb, looky on a Black Betty, bam a lamb, turn around, Black Betty, bam a lamb, jump down, Black Betty.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Black Betty.
We're talking this hour about American music legend, cornerstone of American folk, American rock, inspiration to Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, many more, distant model to a lot of hip-hop culture. Kurt Cobain was inspired as well. Leadbelly. The Smithsonian Folkways Collection box set, Leadbelly, is just out this week, and it is some kind of collection. Black Betty behind us right here. Just so simple and so moving. Just makes you want to move. You can join us this hour. What do you hear in Leadbelly's voice, Leadbelly's story, his song? Do you hear what drew Nirvana, Van Morrison, Bob Dylan, Frank Sinatra, Little Richard, Tom Waits, and so many more? Can you hear what flowed from Leadbelly through folk into rock? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK with Jeff Place, archivist at the Smithsonian Center for Folk Life and Cultural Heritage. Shay is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Shay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So basically, when you put yourself in that atmosphere, when you put his music on and you're in the Louisiana atmosphere, when you're in the Texas, Louisiana, you're there and you put that music on, you hear his voice. I mean, it moves you. So I'll add what I think, because you asked if you think the legend's true. I believe that it's more that this warden, I'm telling you, that's what I think is the truth. I think the warden saw him and cut him out. I think his time was cut short because he was so moved. And so are these other people that found him. I mean, they traveled from everywhere. they obviously had seen a lot of different talent.
Mm-hmm.
And just listen to, I mean, it's
it is so incredible. Shay, what are you hearing? Put it into words. When you listen to that voice, what's he channeling?
He's channeling feeling of being alive.
Yeah.
I mean, in every way that you can. Everything that being alive is, the goods, the bads. What is anything, what is any kind of expression? He's capturing every emotion that you could ever want to capture and move you to something unbelievably further than you could ever want to be, because it's so pure. I hope that answers your question.
I love it. I love it, Shay. The sound of Louisiana coming right through there. Let's just hear more and more. Here's one, Go Down Old Hannah, a song prisoners would sing about the sun, wishing they could escape its blazing heat as they worked. Here's Leadbelly singing the work song, a recording from 1948.
It was soon one morning when the sun did rise, and I was thinking about my good-looking baby, I would hang my head and cry. So long, son. Go down, old Hannah, please don't rise no more. And if you do rise in the morning, set this world on fire.
Leadbelly, 1948. Go Down Old Hannah, just a year before his death. He would die of Lou Gehrig's disease in 1949. Brooke in Oklahoma City. Thank you for calling, Brooke. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say thank you, first of all, to the gentleman at the Smithsonian Folkways for bringing Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly tunes to more people. And for those of us who are from the South, we don't really need anybody to tell us how great those guys are.
Mm-hmm.
They've kept the expressions and sentiments of our families and parents for generations, and it's refreshing to hear on the air. You played in them old cotton fields back home in bourgeois town, and Leadbelly's an incredible social critic, and yeah, I love them. Thanks a lot for this new collection. I can't wait to hear it.
You and me and a lot of other people, Brooke. Thank you very much for your call. Bourgeois town, we played under the opening. Jeff, he did get into political circles, and I wonder how much of the political tone of some of his singing was his own. How much was he singing for those who were around and supporting him, Jeff?
I think he started writing stuff like that early on. I mean, he wrote the song Titanic, which was a civil rights song, you know, back in his days of hanging out with Lemon Jefferson in the teens, right? Whereas, you know, about the, you know, arguing about like the fact that, you know, that here's this ship sank and black people were not allowed to be on it. And, you know, so he's, you know, he was doing stuff early on. I think that, you know, Bourgeois Town was probably written, you know, in the late 30s when he first got to New York, before he actually, you know, really fell in with Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and people who made a living doing that kind of writing. I'm sure he did more of it later during World War II, but he pretty much was writing about, you know, his conscience, what he thought about his whole career.
Titanic, you wouldn't think it'd necessarily be a civil rights song, but he's got this wonderful talk singing stuff in it where he's talking about Jack Johnson, the great African-American boxer, and talking about Jack Johnson wanting to be on that boat, that ship, where they were playing Nearer My God to Thee as it went down, Leadbelly sings. But the captain saying, we don't haul no coal. Black man, we're not going to take you on this boat. And Jack Johnson lucking out because of that.
There were a lot of songs about the Titanic and African-American folklore and music because, you know, people felt that it was, you know, it was sort of divine retribution, I suppose, that, you know, the people had, with, you know, the stance they took, that the boat went down. So I don't know if they were really reveling in the fact that all these people got killed, but it got written up in a lot by a lot of different blues guys.
Here's a little bit from WNYC radio archives. This is in 1941. You can hear this interesting interaction here. The host, Ralph Burton, has Leadbelly on to talk about his music. Burton comes in first, that 1940s announcer talking about life in the Deep South, asks Leadbelly to illustrate with the song TB Blues about tuberculosis.
In the Deep South, as well as in other parts of this land, things aren't all that they should be. And this is one of the, well, I should say, one of the needs for self-expression has shown itself in this blues, the TB Blues, and the lyrics are self-explanatory. Go ahead, Landry.
Now, this is a TV blues. The first girl had the TV, she died. And she liked three or four men. The men what had money wore overhauls. The one was dressed up all the time. He didn't have no dime. She asked him for the dime, and he couldn't give it.
You can hear it right there in that 1941 radio recording Jeff plays. This guy could project no matter what it was. His voice just cut through. And that 12-string guitar as well, he played it with such vigor. This was a strong hand on the guitar.
Well, part of it was the 12-string, he adapted it because, you know, he played loud places, you know, raucous clubs, and he could be heard. His singing was loud. His guitar playing was loud over the crowd. But he also, I think, when he got to New York, when he didn't, you know, there was no PAs, you know, in his world. He really didn't need to do that. He was always sort of a leader at prison. He led people in song, you know, while they work. And so, you know, that was just sort of his personality. It's just a project.
He's been picked up and his songs recorded just again and again and again by so many different artists. Famously, I mean, even the Beach Boys, Cotton Fields, Creedence Clearwater Revival, The Midnight Special, Led Zeppelin, Gallows Pole, Van Morrison, The Midnight Special, Nirvana, Where Did You Sleep Last Night, Odetta, Looking for a Home, Little Richard, Rock Island Line, Pete Seeger and Frank Sinatra, Irene, Tom Waits, Irene, and right on down. Here, this is the Gallows Pole. Gallows as in gallows. Recorded in 1948, later influenced Led Zeppelin's take called Hangman, but here's Leadbelly. Father, did you bring the silver? Did you bring the gold? Keep me from the gallows pole. And you hear that strong hand on the guitar. Jeanette is calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Jeanette, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, I'm listening to that in the background. But,
yeah.
My family is from Northwest Louisiana, from Morningsport, the town where Leadbelly was born.
Yes.
And wow. My aunt used to go to dances in the town where he would play for the dances. So whenever I go back down there, I always make a little pilgrimage because it's very close to his grave, which is behind the Shiloh Baptist Church in Morningsport.
What does he stand for to you, Jeanette?
Oh, those folk songs that when I first heard folk music and heard Cotton Fields, I thought, that's where I grew up. That's the part of Louisiana where I grew up. So he stands for a lot of, bringing us back to listen to that folk music. I think that's what it was for me.
I'm so glad for your call there right out of Morningsport, where, of course, Leadbelly was born. Jeff Place, what about the way his influence rolled into folk and then right on into the rock world?
Well, I think what happened was, you know, poor Leadbelly had really bad timing, you know, getting out of prison when he did. And then in the 40s, he was in New York City, and a lot of these sort of, you know, pop people in the jazz world and stuff didn't want to hear songs about picking cotton and things. So he fell in with the folk crowd, and he influenced a lot of people like Seeger and Guthrie and whatnot, who, after he passed away in 1949, made a, you know, a big deal of championing his music and like the Weavers and different groups playing his songs and getting all his songs into like all these songbooks and schools and summer camps and things. So a whole generation, which became all the big folk stars in the U.S. in the 60s, grew up with that stuff. Same thing happened, but even more in England, where a guy named Lonnie Donegan had a huge hit with Rock Island Line in 54 and influenced all the young future musicians who became the Beatles and Rolling Stones and people like that. Van Morrison all grew up listening to Leadbelly songs.
And not just them. Valerie June is out there and playing today. She draws her sound and inspiration from folk and blues, giants like Leadbelly. We're going to hear from Valerie in just a moment. Here's her 2013 album, Pushing Against the Stone. Here's Working Woman Blues.
Ain't no dinner on the table. Ain't no food in the refrigerator. I go to work and I be back later. I go to work, said I be back later. 'Cause I've been working like a man, y'all. I've been working all my life, yeah. All my life, y'all. All my life, yeah.
Valerie June's Working Women Blues from her album Pushing Against a Stone. Valerie June joins us right now from Washington. It's great to have you, Valerie. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Are you a musical daughter of Leadbelly?
I am. I'd probably be a granddaughter, but I'm a definitely a follower of Leadbelly and very inspired by his music and inspired by his path and the instruments that he played and the genre crossing that he was able to do. He's just a victorious musician in my mind and in my heart. And
is it the history? Is it the history, Valerie? Is it the authenticity? Is it the musicianship?
It's all of it combined. For me, being able to listen to a musician like Leadbelly, who went from doing a children's song to a field song to a ballad, back and forth between folk and blues music, that's just epic in what it does to inspire my music, because I don't just cling to one genre, and listening to his music makes me feel comfortable and free to be able to experiment in different genres.
Valerie, did you come to Leadbelly through going back through the rock vein, going back through the folk vein? How did he show up in your life, his music?
It was through the folk vein. It was through Bob Dylan and Odetta and Pete Seeger, people of that sort, but also a huge fan of Nirvana and Kurt Cobain. So after falling in love with him through the folk musicians, then I began to fall in love with him through people like Nirvana and Van Morrison. So it's been a lot of different paths that led me to him.
Yeah, I would guess so. Jim in Nancy, Kentucky. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just really curious about something. I hadn't heard of Leadbelly. I was very young, back in the early 60s. I was in the Navy. And a friend of mine put on a recording one day of Leadbelly, and I thought I was listening to Fats Domino. And I just wondered, does anybody know if Fats Domino was influenced by Leadbelly or if he copied his style from Leadbelly?
Jeff Place, can I put that to you?
Well, I think it gets back to what I said earlier about the fact that Leadbelly, his guitar, I mean, a lot of his guitar playing was all about his right hand, was strumming and stuff. He was trying to simulate this, like, Louisiana barrel house piano sound. And certainly Fats Domino, growing up in New Orleans, you know, as a pianist, you know, he grew up with that kind of Louisiana barrel house piano, you know, thing, too. So I think they both came from the same kind of place. I don't know, right, can't say 100% that Fats Domino, you know, directly listened to Leadbelly, but they were definitely playing the same style of music from the same place.
We've got an unusual recording here, Big Fat Woman of Leadbelly playing the piano, 1944 recording, figuring out how to play the song Big Fat Woman, which he may have heard while traveling with John and Alan Lomax.
Oh, Lord, big fat woman with a meat chain on the bone. I love my woman and I tell the world I do. I love my woman and I tell the world I do. Oh Lord, I love my woman and I tell the world I do. Oh, she's so good to me just like I do you.
Singer, songwriter, folk musician Valerie June is with us from Washington. Her latest album is Pushing Against a Stone. Valerie, I wonder if you hear, in the way Leadbelly's story was mythologized and presented, you know, the hard time, the prison time, is there some kind of resonance there with the hip-hop gangster stories that we hear today to, you know, to, push up some of those artists and give them edge?
There's a lot of similarity between many of the blues, country blues and Delta blues musicians and hip-hop artists of today in that there were lots of murders and it was a hard way of living in a lot of ways. And I think it's interesting to draw the comparison between the two worlds because a lot of people who listen to hip-hop music of today aren't familiar with the Delta blues or the country blues musicians, but the similarities are evident and true in a lot of the old-time music, and it's just that that's a hard way to live, and people express it in the folk music and the music of their lives and tell those stories. So
the stories in the music and the stories woven around the music and in the lives of the musicians, Leadbelly is kind of a model for that, sometimes embracing it and sharing it, sometimes having it almost imposed on him by an audience that wanted to see him in a certain way. Valerie June, stick with us if you would. It's great to have you here. And Jeff Place, archivist at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, co-producer of the Lead Belly, the Smithsonian Folkways Collection box set, just out behind us right now. Not Lead Belly, but Nirvana, one of many groups, Kurt Cobain and people who have covered Lead Belly. This is Where Did You Sleep Last Night? Lead Belly's version is known as Black Girl. Here's Nirvana's 1993 cover. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
Not through.
Bring a little water, Stevie. Bring a little water now. Bring a little water, Stevie. Every little once in a while, I mean it. Every little once.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about American music legend, cornerstone of American folk, American rock, inspiration to Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, Kurt Cobain, Janis Joplin, distant model to a lot of hip-hop culture, Lead Belly. Hootie, Lead Belly, Leadbetter, out of Louisiana, out of prison in Texas and Louisiana, and into kind of an immortal place in American music history. The Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage is out with a big box set, 108 tracks, Lead Belly, the Smithsonian Folkways Collection, and a companion book with lots of photographs and documentation from that time. Archivist there, Jeff Place, is with us today. So is Valerie June, singer, songwriter, folk musician. Her latest album is Pushing Against a Stone, much inspired, like many other musicians, by the music of Lead Belly. We just heard Bring Me a Little Water, Sylvie there. That's another WNYC 1941 recording, Lead Belly, a song based on a memory of his uncle hollering at his aunt to bring water while he was plowing. A lot of that brought vividly to life. You can join us this hour. What do you hear in Lead Belly's songs, Lead Belly's voice? What's your reaction to this music? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. We heard Nirvana with their Where Did You Sleep Last Night? That came from Lead Belly's Black Girl, Where Did You Sleep? Here's the 1947 recording, Lead Belly.
Black girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pines. In the pond, where the sun never shines, I wish you were all night too. Black girl, where will you go? I'm gone where the cold wind blows. In the pond, where the sun never shines, I wish you were all night too.
Shivering the whole night through there. Lee in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Lee, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to thank you so much. I appreciate the program. It's just incredible. Every time you have a program, it just gets better and better. But I especially wanted to thank your guest for being an archivist. If it were not for people like him dedicating their lives to preserve this type of wonderful music, we just really would have lost tremendous assets. Thank you for having him on. Thank him for being an archivist. And
thank you.
Thank you for the program.
I'll say amen to all that, Lee. Yeah. Thanks for your call. Mike writes to us on Facebook. It's just amazing listening to these recordings, the tinny old sound of the recorder, that drawly voice, take you back 70 years instantly. Mike marveling, he says that technology even allows us to be so privileged. Lee, it's great to hear from you. Scott in Jamestown, New York. Scott, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Jeff. A lot of the artists
that were basically ripping off Lead Belly because they take songs for themselves, didn't give them any writing credit. Elvis, Lonnie Donegan, really, you know, notoriously bad about that with American black artists of that age, whereas like Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and stuff, they would give, you know, those artists credit. And also Lonnie Donegan's people one time went to Lead Belly's publishers and walked in and said, you know, why is, you know, Lead Belly ripping off our guy? And they were promptly escorted from the premises under the threat of pain, apparently.
Lonnie Donegan, of course, the British musician, covered Rock Island Line. Jeff Place, what about credit being given here? I mean, you note that Lead Belly had the misfortune to live before the music that he championed and brought forward really became huge. But what about the fairness of what ensued with so many people piling on music? It was very shortly after his death that the Weavers had a huge hit with Goodnight Irene, and it just went on and on. How do you look at that, Jeff?
Well, it's a mixture. I mean, the Weavers definitely credited him, you know, for everything that he did, you know, along with themselves. They had themselves the songwriting credits because they changed things around with it. But later on, there was a certainly, you know, we're talking about later musicians. There was this idea that he was singing old folk songs that were somehow anonymous and from the public domain. So it's okay if we just say we wrote it. You know, there was a lot of that in the late 50s. And thankfully for Lead Belly, his niece, Tiny Robinson, took over kind of, you know, the estate and was really, you know, forthright about going out, you know, after these people to make sure, you know, they got their just desserts.
Maya in Detroit, Michigan. Maya, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you hear, Maya?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that in Lead Belly's voice, I truly hear the African-American experience and just the resonance of the African-American experience throughout American culture and how with that there's a dialogue with all members of American society. And you just get a sense of how critical, you know, this experience is to American culture as a whole, but yet and still we must credit this is African-American culture here in Lead Belly's voice.
Let's credit that loud and clear, and it definitely comes through. It captures so much of the South and of a people and of an experience. Maya, I appreciate your call. Valerie June, do you share that sense of this as representing for a whole part of the American population?
It does. It represents quite a lot in our culture, and he was, to me, a collector of not only songs of the folk tradition and the blues tradition, but the prison songs. And so many of those prisoners weren't able to sing their songs for the world. So for him to be there collecting their songs and then to bring them, once he got out of prison, to bring them to the world, I think that's amazing. Like, did he write every single song that he's known for singing? No, but some of those songs, they were songs that were sung by prisoners who probably died in prison and weren't ever able to be heard.
He was a sponge. He channeled the world, you write, Jeff Place. He could hear just a snippet of a song and keep it with him. Here's Lead Belly with Rock Island Line. This is a song that the story goes he first heard in 1934 while traveling with John and Alan Lomax. Changed the lyrics to make it a song about the railroad, Rock Island Line. Later became a hit for Lonnie Donegan, the British musician, as well as Johnny Cash. Here's Lead Belly's Rock Island Line.
Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want us to ride, you got to ride it like you find it. Get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. A, B, C, double X, Y, Z. You got the undercover, but they don't see me. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road.
Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Place. Mm-hmm. My question is relating to John Lomax's presence with Lead Belly. John Lomax being a great collector of songs, I'm wondering if Lead Belly's eclecticism, particularly his use of white folk music, white country music, and adapting it, how much of that is Lead Belly himself, or how much is John Lomax affecting that?
That's a wonderful question. Jeff Place, what do you say?
Well, I think he did get some things from the Lomaxes. The Lomaxes had collected the song House of the Rising Sun from a woman named Georgia Turner and put it in their books, and he pretty much plays that version. But I think most of the stuff he did was his own. He was collecting, white, folk country songs too, way before he ever met the Lomaxes. I mean, you know, even the song Black Girl, which exists both in black and white music. I mean, in white music, it was an old folk song called In the Pines. It gets covered by Bill Monroe and people. So he was doing that pretty much his, you know, his whole life. I mean, you know, I don't know. I wasn't, you know, present when Lomax was having had him present for these, you know, the folklore academics and stuff. He's probably trying to get him to play the, you know, the real folk, you know, traditional type stuff for them. But once he got to the point where he was like working for Moses Ash, you know, recording commercially, Ash let him do whatever he wanted because he was interested in all of Lead Belly's music.
But I find it so interesting in reading into the book that accompanies this, the extent to which people, there was a certain way they wanted to see him. I mean, we associate Lead Belly with authenticity. And yet he was, in some respects, a kind of project. They would package him. They'd dress him up in prison garb. How much do you see as authentic, whatever that means? That's a funny word. And how much imposed by those who sort of escorted him up out of prison to the north into recording?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of that. I mean, you know, when he got, you know, when he got to New York, yes, he did perform in prison outfits. And, you know, now we look at that as like, you know, that's pretty, you know, offensive, you know, in retrospect, you know. But like my research has shown that a lot of these like folklore acts that were kind of presented back then, even if they were white, would be dressed like as, you know, kind of Appalachian guys in bib overalls. It's kind of the stereotype thing. You know, the record company people wanted to make him a blues guy, or, you know, and try to sell him that way. It didn't work. He was, you know, he was just, he was too much his own man, you know. So yeah, in New York, but they were trying to like market him as, you know, this crazy guy from, you know, this wild murderer from the, you know, it was they being pretty much the media, this guy from the country, you know, and that's not kind of what he wanted to be. You know, he dressed in a three-piece suit all the time with perfectly shined shoes. He wanted to be a pop star. He wanted to be someone like Nat King Cole, you know?
Chuck in Columbia, Tennessee. Thank you for calling, Chuck. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a rather ironic experience just now leaving my home in Middle Tennessee. I passed a work gang on the side of the road. So this is very relevant to me, the discussion and the applications that you're talking about.
Like a prison work gang. What would have been a chain gang back in the day, Chuck?
Well, pretty much still is, and they're out in the freezing cold right now in the shade. I don't think they're real happy, and to see those faces just takes you right back. The other comment I wanted to make was about Lead Belly. My first observation about him was his use of the 12-string guitar, which obviously went on to a lot of folk singers and, of course, Roger McGuinn and the Byrds and all that stuff. So that's what I had to contribute.
Chuck, you bring an irony front and center for us. Valerie June, Chuck's still driving by work gang, chain gang along the side of the road as he listens to us celebrating Lead Belly. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm trying to hear you clearly. I'm having some trouble with the connection, but...
Oh, I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry. Let's get just a little more of the music here. Let's go to one. This is interesting. A Lead Belly song, If It Wasn't for Dickie. This is his version of an Irish song about a milk cow. Then the Weavers, Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes, took the melody Lead Belly created and put new lyrics to it, writing Kisses Sweeter Than Wine, which a lot of people will know. Here's Lead Belly with If It Wasn't for Dickie.
Now, if it wasn't for Dickie, I would kill you right now. But his old man, he had but one cow. He would send her to the fields to be fed, and it would have been a drama drop here. Oh, which is sitting down.
If it wasn't for Dickie, it would get Kisses Sweeter Than Wine. It has a different sound to it. And you get a different sound again when you get into the 60s. Here's Creedence Clearwater Revival covering the Midnight Special by Lead Belly. This is their 1969 version.
Yonder come Miss Rosie. How in the world did you know? By the way she wears an apron and the clothes she wore. Umbrella on her shoulder. Piece of paper in her hand. She come to see the governor. She want to free her.
Creedence Clearwater Revival Midnight Special, 1969. And you hear how that sound of the 60s, of so much rock in the 60s, goes straight back to Lead Belly. Kim in Lowell, Massachusetts. Kim, you're on.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you for doing this show. I forget sometimes these guys were out there and how much influence they had. One of my favorite artists, I'm also a singer, is Bonnie Raitt, and the first album I bought of hers was her 71 album, Since I Fell for You. And one of my favorite songs from that is Walkin' Blues. And I know that Lead Belly had a lot of influence on her and other female artists who, you know, just bring that, like other people have been saying, that American culture out. And it's just wonderful that that he was around and was able to, you know, give these guys influence to take their music to another level.
Yeah, I just
and
kept...
Just one
yes, yes.
I'm sorry, just one last comment. I just almost fell off my chair when I heard Gallo's poll. I had no idea.
Right. You're thinking all more contemporary versions in your mind. Kim, I appreciate your call. It is amazing, Jeff Place, how when the 60s came and people wanted that sound of authenticity, here was the touchstone, and it had immediate kind of credibility across the country, I guess in part from the seeds planted by Leadbelly and his huge repertoire.
Well, yeah, people had heard, you know, had heard his music growing up over the years. You know, they grew up, you know, the whole folk revival of the late 50s and early 60s, and it was, you know, he and like Robert Johnson, there's a handful of these guys, these blues musicians. Robert Johnson, of course, was the guy who did Walkin' Blues, was just mentioned. You know, they kind of were like the iconic blues guys, and people coming up, you know, would probably frequently would hear like some kind of rock and roll group covering Lead Belly and Robert Johnson or something. And someday some buddy who they knew, sort of the, who had a great record collection would, you know, bring out the original and play it for them. And that would be the end of that. They'd gravitate right back to the original person.
It's an incredible story, the way it channels what sounds like our history is our history, and yet without somebody like Leadbelly out there collecting it in prisons and fields and on Fannin Street back in Shreveport, who knows what would have come along to us and what wouldn't have. Valerie June, I hope you just keep playing in this vein. It just keeps inspiring, I guess, Valerie.
It does. It keeps carrying on. And he has so many songs that were recorded, and the inspiration of him playing the accordion and the piano, not just the 12th string. He played mandolin. He played so many different instruments. So there's endless inspiration in Leadbelly's legacy.
It keeps going right there in the music of Valerie June. Her latest album is Pushing Against a Stone. Valerie, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Jeff Place, archivist at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, thanks so much for all your work on this huge box set, this wonderful book of documents and amazing photographs. What a handsome guy Leadbelly was. Jeff Place, thanks for joining us from Washington today.
Well, thanks, Tom, for having me.
We'll go out with Leadbelly singing his song Fannin Street from Fannin Street in Shreveport, Louisiana, where some of the best musicians gravitated, Red Light District there, where he picked up guitar, recorded here in 1949. Thanks for joining us today. Thank you, Leadbelly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Anybody should ask you people who made up this song, tell them you get a Leadbelly, he's done been here.